Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Before we get started, just a note, this episode contains some strong language as well as content that may not be suitable or at least ready for younger ears. It is an episode about sex ed. Okay, thanks.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Molly Webster. This is Gonads episode 6, and it's our last episode. I'm going to go cry after this is done. But first, I want to share with you this really fun thing that Team Gonads did in May. And that is we did a live event on sex ed. You know, if you've been listening to this series, we have been looking at the biology of biological sex and sex determination. And one of the things we kept thinking was like, man, now that we know how complicated it is, like, how do we teach this stuff? And how do we teach this stuff in a climate where people are really polarized and divided? In thinking about all this, sex ed, it just felt like more than a radio story. You know, if you bring up sex ed with anybody, they have stories, they get excited, they get animated, and it really felt like something that would live quite beautifully in a live space, in a live event, you know, almost like recreate the sex ed classes we all may or may not have gone through. So today we'll be bringing you clips of that show, and it starts with Jad Abumrad.
Hello, hello. How are you guys doing? All right. So excited you were here. So I guess I should just say, welcome to Radiolab Sex Ed. That is a sentence I never thought I would say. In the 15 years I've been doing the show, I never anticipated this moment where I'd be on stage saying that to a live group of humans. But, you know, here we are. And I grew up in Tennessee, so I actually didn't have sex ed. So I am looking forward to learning something tonight. Please welcome to the stage Radiolab's Molly Webster.
Hello. Hello, hello, hello. Whew. Well. This kind of feels like my sex ed class, which was like nerve-wracking and you're not sure how it's gonna go. So to start the night, we are gonna go down south. Mississippi, 2011. The state passes a law that places some restrictions on sex ed, notably when it comes to talking about condoms.
The law specifically says no instruction or demonstration on the application of a condom.
So that's Sanford Johnson. He is a sex educator in Mississippi. And so on the one hand, you might think, no big deal, right? It's just a piece of plastic. Kids can figure out how to use it. We don't have to show them everything. But Sanford says it's not really that easy.
I will tell you a story from when I was a high school teacher here in the Mississippi Delta. Because
the school brought in a guest certified sex educator to talk to the kids about sex.
He said this quote that has It has stuck with me for 15 years now. But he said, when you make a condom, and the time it takes you to drive it from the factory to the store, it loses half of its effectiveness. And then he said that in the time it takes you to drive it from the store to your house, it loses another half of its effectiveness. And in the time it takes you to take it out of the wrapper and actually put it on, it loses another half of its effectiveness. And I was thinking, that's not how math works.
So Sanford and all of his teacher friends were like, well, if this is what kids are being told, maybe we really do need to do those condom demonstrations. But the question is, how? So for Sanford, this all came to a head at a teacher training that he was at. So the teacher training was to train teachers in how to teach sex ed. And as part of the training, one of the teachers was like up in front of the group, and she was supposed to explain how to use a condom, because this is the caveat in the law. You can talk about a condom, but you can't explain or like show how to use one. And so this teacher...
She was a hand talker. So as she talked, she pantomimed a lot. And as she was reading the steps, like, she couldn't help but actually pantomime how to put on a condom. And somebody from the State Department said, I don't think you should do that. I really don't think you should do that. Like, that's a condom demonstration.
Talking with her hands was now illegal.
And it got to the point where, as she's saying the steps, she actually has her hands behind her back. And, like, that's how she's giving it. Like, that's how she's going through the steps. So we thought it was the most hilarious thing in the world.
It's hilarious, yes. But it's also, like, we need to tell these kids about condoms, and we don't really know how to do it. And so thinking about this, the next day, Sanford came up with something that I think might be one of my most favorite things on the internet.
Hi, my name is Sanford Johnson. I'm here in sex ed training right now.
It's kind of this, like, grainy, in the shadows iPhone video in which Sanford Johnson is standing there with 1 foot barefoot while he's holding a white tube sock and a sneaker. And remember, according to Mississippi law, he's not allowed to perform an actual condom demonstration with a condom. So what he does is he holds up this tube sock to the camera and he says,
I want to teach kids how to put on a sock. If you're going to be engaged in a sock activity, whether you're wearing an athletic shoe or whether you're using a dress shoe, doesn't matter to me as long as your foot is protected. I want to make sure that you have on a sock. So if I'm putting on a sock, what I do is I start with a sock and I'm going to pinch out the air out of the tip of the sock because I want to make sure that there's room for my toes when I'm engaging in a shoe activity. And then I take the sock and I put it on top of my foot and all I do is just roll it down. Just roll it down. Now some people stop right here and just only put that sock on halfway. That's not how you do it. You want to take your sock and you want to roll it all the way down your foot. You want to roll it all the way down your foot, and then you can put it inside your shoe. And then you're ready to engage in the shoe activity. Now, when I'm done...
This video lives on our website, and you should absolutely go watch it when you're done with this episode. This video is delightful, but it served a larger purpose for us, which is that it reminded us that there are a lot of different ways to have conversations about sex and the body. And we thought, okay, what if for our live show, we try to reframe the conversations happening around sex ed? What if we use metaphor and euphemism and comedy, maybe even a little meditation, as a way to navigate all the stuff swirling around sex ed, whether that's a law in Mississippi or just the general awkwardness that comes with this topic? So to do this, one thing Sanford and sex educators from all across the country told us was that a key part of a sex ed classroom was a question box where students could drop in anonymous questions and then the teachers would pull them out and answer them to try and facilitate discussion. So we thought, what if we make our own question box and try and answer the questions with this reframing? So we gathered questions from listeners, Reddit, Sanford, fifth graders. It's in no way comprehensive, but we gave it a try. To kick us off, here's Maige O'Connery singing the first question. This is just her, a mic, and a vocoder.
What are periods? What are periods? Oh, what are periods? Oh, what?
it's really an unbelievable pain. It feels like someone's shoving a knife up inside me and then turning it slowly, but with no rhythm that I can track, so I can never quite get my head on top of it, of predicting it. It feels like I'm like in hell and I can't move.
That's Cinda Aga. She's 24, a filmmaker, and she's talking about what she goes through every month when she gets her period. Now, periods, sort of a weird topic, still a little taboo, hush hush. I say paternalism, maybe. Like, it is a little hard though. Roughly half the planet doesn't get them. And even if you do, every period is so different. They're kind of hard to talk about. But Cinda has seemingly found a new language for discussing her period, and it's with kind of an unexpected companion. Some background.
So I have endometriosis, which is a reproductive illness that 1 in 10 American women have, where your endometrium, which is usually the lining of your uterus that gets shed during your period, starts growing in all these places it's not supposed to. So on your organs and your intestines.
Wait, it actually starts growing outside of your uterus?
That's what endometriosis is.
So each month, and I had no idea about this. I feel embarrassed as a 35-year-old woman to have gotten to this point and not known this. But each month, your body tries to push out all that extra tissue that's in places, and it can't.
It can't get rid of it.
And so it's very painful. And you can take birth control to help eliminate the pain, which Cinda did for many years, but then she started getting depressions and all these complications, and so she had to stop. And as soon as she did, the pain came rushing back.
I got my first period off of birth control. I was maybe 22 years old. And it hit me when I was at the airport in Casablanca in Morocco alone. So I was traveling back from Liberia.
She'd been making a documentary for the BBC and was about to fly home.
And I got my period, and I had like 30 minutes till I was supposed to board my flight to JFK to get back to the United States. And all of a sudden, I couldn't move.
She said she just sort of froze in place in front of the food court.
And a janitor ended up coming up to me and being like, "Are you okay?" in Arabic. And I was like, "I kind of speak French. I don't speak Arabic." And he was like, "Are you okay?" in French. And I responded, and I was like, "Oh, I don't have to say period in French."
He was very helpful, but the pain was so bad, she was just like, "I have to call somebody."
And I still had Wi-Fi, so I called my dad.
Which I was kind of surprised about. Like, I'm pretty close to my dad, but he's not the period guy. Maybe we're old-fashioned. I don't know. So we called them both into the studio to talk about it.
All right.
Okay, so I'm Gul Aga. I'm professor, and I'm her dad.
I asked him, what was it like to get that phone call?
You know, it was harder for me because I couldn't do anything. You're sort of helpless, and all you can do is sit there and feel the emotions, but not be able to, you know.
I feel really bad for you, yeah.
Gul said that on that call, while Cinda was in the Casablanca airport and he was all the way in Illinois, he just started trying to do everything.
Close your eyes, take a deep breath. What are you feeling?
Meanwhile, Cinda is literally...
I sound like I'm having a baby.
In pain, yeah. It's like being in the labor room.
She was crying and moaning, and Gul's trying to make her feel better. He's like tossing out all these ideas, but the pain's still really bad.
And then my dad said, "Think about a color. Like, think about the color red. And then shift it to a different color in your brain."
In that moment, Cinda became 11 years old again. It was her first period, and the pain was terrible.
I was laying in bed. My mom couldn't be there. And she was, you know, almost always there, but she had to be at work. I was having really bad cramps. So it was my dad and my uncle leaning over me trying to help me. And I was just like mortified, but I was in too much pain to like really worry about it. And so yeah, my dad turned on Gregorian chants and he burned some incense and he started waving it over my head. And he was saying like, just track the smoke with your eyes and just follow it, follow it. Okay, imagine you are the smoke and you're just floating. And I was really committing to this. I was like, okay, I'm the smoke. And then he was like, okay, close your eyes. Imagine a color. What color are you seeing? I was like, red, obviously, because that's on my period.
Cinder realized in that moment she could actually see the pain. It was a thing that had a shape to it that she could identify.
And then he was like, okay, and now try to change it into a different color with your brain. I was like, I guess blue.
Cinda found herself thinking back to that moment and once again talking to her dad and trying to transform the color of the pain.
I remember standing then on the little staircase that leads up to the plane, and I was like gripping onto the bar, trying not to fall over, and like gritting my teeth, just like clenching my jaw. And I was just like, okay, the color red. Okay, I see it. Yeah, I see it. All right. Okay, come on. Turn into something else. Pink, maybe. Okay, all right.
And she says, standing there, about to board the 7-hour flight, it actually helped.
I mean, I was still in really bad pain, but mentally I can stay here.
Sit inside of it.
It's, I guess, really non-judgmental.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, I'm feeling pain. Let's really feel it.
It's very Sufi, because in Sufi tradition and Sindhi culture.
And so Cinda and her dad are from southern Pakistan.
You don't like try to avoid suffering. Instead, you just try to express it. Like when someone dies, there's literally professional wailers that you hire to come wail and cry with you, right? Or maybe you don't pay them, but you were telling me about this.
Yeah, that is common. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and every time somebody comes visiting, the whole story is repeated, and then the professional wailers start
crying. It's their job to, like, express suffering.
And it's to get you to cry again.
It's not to be the crier if you can't cry. No. It's actually to get you to keep going through it.
Yes.
To keep crying, to keep pushing through the feeling.
Right.
So sit with the pain. That's point number one. And point number two is pain to me seems pretty dark. I don't know about you, but I don't know if I would actually think about a color. But Cinda said for her family, it's not that surprising because her dad's like a little obsessed with color.
You know, you would always wear like post-it note, hot pink, bright orange, like purple. You're wearing purple right now. Is that culture or is that just you not caring?
Well, no, there are many people in the culture.
Like men wear pink.
Pink would be unusual. Red is more common.
And Cinda's laughing here, but if she was being honest, she would say that when she was a kid, this color palette...
Well, this used to really embarrass me. Now I'm proud of it. Sorry.
In the end, color was a place that she and her dad were able to meet. And then just keep meeting. Because the month after Morocco, another period, more pain, she called her dad. The next month, another period, more pain, she called her dad. And then the next month,
Yeah.
What are you saying and doing in those moments?
So the first thing I'm trying to do is just to get her to be in the color,
mm-hmm.
rather than sort of trying to switch it right away. You know, can you really feel it?
Yeah, I'll close my eyes and I'll focus in on where the pain is and what it feels like. And I let it just kind of shoot up into my brain. And it fills it kind of like if you watched like a watercolor kind of like wash across a page, you know? And everything's red all of a sudden. And the first thing I think is, aha, yeah, that's it. Like, I've identified it.
Try to be one with it in a way. See what do you see? What do you feel?
And then... I try to just kind of shift the color. It'll start like, you know, changing the tint a little bit into orange, and it's still like mixing with the red, and then pushing it all the way to something different, like a pink, you know? It's like a wash, and it gets, like, thicker and thicker, and then all of a sudden the wave is coming in a different color.
At this point in the live show, we put onto the screen these amazing images. They're hyper-saturated, poppy, surreal, and they're made by Cinda. If you want to see them, you can go to radiolab.org/gonads and check them out. Cinda's inspiration for these photographs is what she sees in her mind's eye when she's in incredible pain. And she's able to capture the images and write them down as her dad is coaching her through these color meditations.
Think of the sea, think of the clouds, think of blue. And just consider the vastness of the ocean.
Yeah, that's a classic one.
Goes on, and waves come and waves go.
My dad, he thinks a lot about the scale of the universe and the scale of all time.
And nothing stays, nothing is permanent.
And our smallness, and how insignificant our unhappiness and our suffering is when you think about all of that.
Waves come and waves go.
And he just makes me feel, it sounds weird because he's very loving, but he like makes me feel how little I matter. And it calms me down.
Think of waves. The vastness of the ocean goes on, and waves come and waves go, and nothing stays, nothing is permanent. It all just seems very real, and yet it's gone, and it continues, and it's gone, and waves come and waves go. And it's a sea of blue. And then imagine you're one of those bubbles, just froths. Your pain is one of those bubbles. It'll increase, and then it'll just pop. It'll be gone. And then more waves will come.
That's cool.
That was good. That was actually realistic.
You still call him?
I always call him.
And how do you, like, schedule that amongst? Like, for you, I would almost be like, oh, crap, is today the day she's going to call? And, like, how do I book my afternoon?
It is in your calendar.
Well, it was, yeah, it is my calendar.
What is the difference?
My period is in my dad's calendar. He's blushing.
That was filmmaker Cinda Aga and her father, Ghul Aga. We'll be back with Radiolab Live Sex Ed, the final episode in the Gonad series. Here on Gonads, we've been talking about the biology of sex and sex determination, and I can't help but think that the one place this all plays out is dating.
Anna, do you remember our summer of single?
Oh my God, I do. Mine was very short.
Yeah, yours lasted like a week. Mine is still going.
This is why we're excited that our good friends over at Death, Sex, and Money, led by Anna Sale, are taking on the topic of dating. They're following a group of listeners for the entire summer.
They're a variety of ages. Some are straight, some are gay, some are online dating, some aren't. And they're all over the country.
Through these stories, they'll be thinking about all sorts of things that come up in dating.
Who are you attracted to and why? Like, when it becomes intimate, like, what kind of intimacy feels right? And all of these things feel like right now they're like very much up for grabs and also something a lot of us are talking about abstractly.
To listen, you can check out Hot Dates.
Because it's dating in the summertime.
On the Death, Sex, and Money podcast feed. Go get it.
Hi, this is Emily in Louisville, Kentucky. Radiolab presents Gonads is supported in part by Science Sandbox, a Simons Foundation initiative dedicated to engaging everyone with the process of science. Additional support for Radiolab is provided by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
Radiolab is supported by Cozy Earth. When you think about summer comfort, words like breezy or soft maybe come to mind. With Cozy Earth's luxurious bedding and loungewear, you'll get the comfort of home wherever you roam, allowing you to elevate your summer getaway no matter where or even if you're getting away. Cozy Earth bedding is temperature regulating and made from top-notch materials, including viscose from bamboo that can turn any living or sleeping space into a sanctuary of luxury and comfort. Their loungewear and pajamas offer you their signature level of comfort while maintaining an elegant fit so you can look cute and be comfy even if you're taking a long flight or car trip. Cozy Earth provided an exclusive offer for Radiolab listeners. Get 35% off site-wide when you use the code Radiolab at www.cozyearth.com. That's 35% off at cozyearth.com, code Radiolab. Discover your next destination for ultimate comfort at Cozy Earth. Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic, but you don't have to be because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Gonads, episode 6. This is our live show about sex ed. So far, we've talked about condom demos without any condoms, periods. We even went on to talk about the deeply important topic of what happens to all the bananas after condom banana demos. But we ultimately went on to discuss a question that is one of the primary reasons I wanted to do this show.
Anything, is there anything off limits?
What you'll find is you can get together a room full of people who you think have the same opinion on what should be taught in sex ed in schools, but once you boil it down to the nitty-gritty and the fine details, you realize everybody draws a line somewhere. And to wrestle with that line drawing, we got together a panel of really smart people who think about this, and we presented them with real-world scenarios we ran into while reporting this issue, and we tried to have them do something where they, like, waved flags for when they thought a line was crossed or for when they supported the line that was being drawn. I'm not sure if the flag thing worked, but you may hear reference to it.
And so I would like to welcome to the stage, I'm going to move. Maybe I shouldn't. I'm going to stand here, and then they'll come, and then I'll go. education historian and author of the sex ed book Too Hot to Handle, John Zimmerman. Muslim youth activist Dahlia. And sex educator Erica Hart. Okay, so the first one, December 1st, 1994, Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders, who was appointed by Bill Clinton, condoned the idea of teaching school children to masturbate as a way of avoiding the spread of AIDS. She was asked by Dr. Rob Clark, a psychologist at a UNAIDS conference, about the prospects of a more explicit discussion and promotion of masturbation as a means to limit the spread of the virus. And she began her reply by saying she was a very strong advocate of sex ed in schools at an early age. And quote, as per your specific request in regard to masturbation, I think that is something that is part of human sexuality and is something that should be taught.
I think masturbation is really, really important, and I think that people should learn about it, and I feel like it should be taught as part of like a sex ed curriculum, but for this reason, absolutely not. I think like she really like politicized that reason, and it was used not for her own sexual benefits, but as like a way to downplay AIDS and be like, this is terrible, I don't want anyone to know about this or deal with this. So like, I don't, this seems like a red flag to me.
Interesting. John?
This episode was completely miscast and misunderstood. It was an invented media non-event.
Mm-hmm.
It was reported as Joyce and Elders saying that she thought that in schools, teachers should teach students how to masturbate.
Mm-hmm.
That is not what she was saying. What she was saying was masturbation is a part of human sexuality, and people should be informed about that. That's very different than saying we're going to teach them how to masturbate.
Mm-hmm. Which I would then pose to the panel, like, would you go as far as doing a how-to in a sex ed class? How to masturbate, or do you just introduce it as an idea?
We're talking about now in K-12 schools?
Well, we can talk about what, if there's a yes in there, I'd want to know what age. If there's a no, I'm curious if that's age related.
You can't necessarily teach how to, and I think also speaking to what you said about Jocelyn Elders, this is another example of how race and sexuality gets conflated, or not necessarily conflated, but definitely comes to the table, of that Jocelyn Elders was like literally, essentially lost her career talking about this, which just shows the anti-black origins of ever talking about sex and how our bodies are used and on the lines, but when we start talking about ways that we can actually own them, it's now a problem. And the other part of that is that you can't necessarily teach someone how to masturbate, hashtag Cosmo. You can't really do that. Because everybody has a different body, right? And everybody's bodies function differently. Like, for example, me, I'm a breast cancer survivor. I don't have nipples. So to be like, oh, you can stimulate your nipples, that would be triggering for me because I don't have that body part. But if you could just say, touch your body in the ways that feel good for you, like I told my fifth graders yesterday, and they were like, what? Like, what does that mean? I'm like, any part of your body you could touch, and that is called masturbation, right? So now they know what it means, and there's not this weird thing around this, am I doing it right, miss? Which I get questions about all the time. Like, am I doing it right? I'm like, does it feel good to you? Then, yes.
This has been a hugely contested question across American history.
Mm-hmm.
Masturbation
specifically?
Yes, specifically. And if you don't want to read about masturbation, don't study sex education, because you find it's the most contested subject. And the reason is it's explicitly and only about pleasure, right? Mm-hmm. It's not about procreation. And even though I expect that many people in this audience think that sex is for pleasure, it's important to understand that there are, you know, some 330 million Americans, and not all of them agree with that premise, right? Some of them think that it's only reserved for heterosexual marriage, and it's only reserved for procreation. And that's why they object to discussions of masturbation, because masturbation, by definition, doesn't fit that framework.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, what's the role that religion has in this? Because masturbation is so tightly tied to, you know, I was raised Catholic, definite no-no, right? It's so tightly tied to that. I wonder, how do you respect sort of like religious space when you want to introduce a topic like masturbation?
Yeah, I'm like,
I mean, a lot of my students will say things like, well, for example, God is a man. And I don't necessarily agree with that, but I have to kind of hold space for that. That's their understanding of it. Mm-hmm. So same thing with masturbation, where it's like, I can't masturbate because I'm Christian or I'm Catholic. I'm like, okay, so you will not masturbate then. But I still have to talk about masturbation as you are in my sex ed class. And that's a topic that I'm going to talk about and not necessarily not talk about because there's some students who are religious. It's like, you don't have to opt in to everything that I'm saying. Mm-hmm. It's just knowledge for you, so you don't go around shaming yourself or someone else for engaging in such behavior.
John?
It's really difficult, you know? I mean, there's shockingly little sex ed in this country. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but one reason is that we differ so fundamentally about sex and sexuality. You know, I mean, we're here in Lower Manhattan. This is not a representative audience, okay?
Yeah, yeah. And
sex is tied to, use a loaded word, our most intimate ideas of ourselves as human beings. And many of those are faith-inflected. You know, and so if you look at Western democracies, what you find is people that object to sex education now, they often cluster among two groups, white evangelical Christians and also recent immigrants, especially immigrants from the Muslim and the Hindu world. You know, and these are often groups that agree about nothing else. But in the UK and Sweden and Canada and the United States, every account of their shared objections, every newspaper account must use the headline, Strange Bedfellows.
Yeah.
I've never seen a single journalistic account, because it works perfectly, right?
Yeah.
I mean, these are people that basically agree about nothing, including immigration, right? But this is hard, and it should be hard for people like myself on the left, because we say we value diversity, but we also want this thing called comprehensive sex education. How are you going to square that circle?
Dahlia, you're nodding. Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, so I was raised Muslim, and I think it's not a don't teach your kids about sex. It's more of it's an unspoken heterosexual, we use it to procreate type way. And I hate like feeding into this like American narrative of like Muslims are like all straight cis heterosexuals, but I'm like, fuck.
We're not.
But also that's how a lot of us were raised, unfortunately. And like with new generations coming in, we're like all queer and whatnot. But... But it's hard to navigate sex in general, let alone masturbation, because there is a stigma that's tied not just within the religion, but within our own communities, depending on where we're coming from.
Okay, so this one happened at Charter School, Rockland, California. So a kindergarten class, a student can bring in a book, and the book can be read during story time. And so for one of the weeks, a transgender student brought in a book called I Am Jazz, which is a book about a transgender kid. The teacher read the book in class. And then there was a really interesting reaction from the parents, like, holy crap, we were not prepared for this. Our kids came home with very confused and tons of questions. And I thought that this was an interesting one because a lot of what we've been talking about is sort of formalized sex ed, and this is informal sex ed.
I don't necessarily think that it's informal per se. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just about a person's experience. Mm-hmm. And what cis normativity does, which is cis meaning like the world is very cis gender dominant, is like, this is weird. Now we're gonna, maybe we should have had a letter about this. You didn't need a letter about talking about George Washington or the Civil War or the Vietnam War or World War II. So why is it that when you're talking about a trans person that now you need to be warned that you're gonna talk about this?
Dahlia, what about you? I know when we were talking backstage, you said you could go either way on this one.
Yeah, because my only qualm is like cis people don't know how to facilitate discussions about gender with their kids, obviously, especially if you're a kindergarten and you're asking, like, am I a boy, am I a girl, like these questions mm-hmm. that you said this year to ask. So I wish that the parents knew about it just so they'd be able to facilitate a conversation. So it would have been like a productive experience for the kindergartners themselves. A letter would have been okay. Like, I'm kind of like, a letter would have been better because so that way they would have been able to know about this beforehand. So, like, the kid wouldn't come in at, like, 4 p.m. and be like, I don't know what's happening. This is what happened at school today. So if they knew about it beforehand, I feel like it could have been a more productive conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
John, any thoughts?
Look, it's really hard. I share the sentiments that we just heard about cisnormativity, and I'm deeply supportive of trans rights. But I'm also supportive of public schools, and I understand that they are under threat. All right. And I think that there's a really delicate balance here. If you want people to support your public schools, you can't at the same time transmit the message that somehow they just didn't get this thing, this sex thing right. And we, the school, have to intervene.
There is a fear. I mean, I think in what you were saying, there's a centering of institutions in this country. It's like the institution needs to be upheld. Like, oh, don't mess up the school. The school is going to fall apart. And if the school falls apart, then we have nothing rather than centering the most marginalized. And I think to think that a school is going to fall apart, but not trans folks and non-binary people and genderqueer people, and to not think about their experience is a mind fuck, for lack of a better word. So I think what is missing in sex education is talking about intersectionality, which is not just this celebration of various identities, but talking about the ways in which people are impacted by systems of oppression. So actually talking about that when you talk about masturbation, is this really something that someone has access to? If you're talking about putting on a condom, why is it that Mississippi, the poorest country in this country, cannot talk about condoms? Mm-hmm. Like, that is really a function of race and class, right? And really being mindful of that and really bringing that into your classrooms. And people don't necessarily do that. They're like, oh, let's just talk about sex and let's just have this conversation and not be mindful of the things in which, like, people are also bringing to the table.
Yeah, John?
I agree with all that. I just think that a true and honest intersectional approach would also acknowledge that a lot of recent immigrants to this country find a lot of these themes anathema. Don't think they belong in a public school. Believe that they're familial and religious matters and not school matters. I'm not saying I agree with them. Mm-hmm. I am saying, though, that an honest intersectional approach would have to acknowledge that, would have to take account of the fact that we are a diverse society, and many of our recent immigrants, not all, but many, find these themes inappropriate for a public school.
But that's the opposite of what I said. I said it matters that you actually talk about where people are from, mm-hmm. and that you actually get interested. And if someone is dealing with being documented, they probably don't want to talk about masturbation. Oh,
that may be- As the conversation went on, I wouldn't say that we ever actually came to a consensus on any single scenario. And you can feel it gets thorny. But what was brought into the room were all of the different things that go into thinking about how lines are drawn in sex ed. So race, immigration, class, maturity, body type, age. We went on to discuss other scenarios. Some of my favorites are...
Bondage in ninth grade?
Introducing bondage to ninth graders.
I'm going to say 12th grade.
Or live BDSM demonstrations.
Attendees were warned 5 to 10...
Because, yes, that has actually happened on a college campus somewhere. We aren't able to play all those for you here on this podcast, but what we are going to do is play you the final segment of the night, which is a batch of questions from what is sort of the quintessential sex ed target population.
Oh, lightning round!
Okay, so I'll just do a little thing. So last week we heard about this sex educator who made an amazing discovery. This educator was teaching a workshop at a middle school in southern Maine, and they were talking to the school nurse, and as they talked, they saw that on the nurse's desk there was this, like, overflowing envelope. And she asked what it was, and it turns out the nurse said, oh, those are my fifth graders' sex ed questions. And so we obviously were like, we want those. Thank you very much for telling us this story. And they're pretty great. And so we're coming to the end of the night. And like all sex ed classes, we've only gotten through about 5 questions. And so one of the things Sanford tells me that they do is they'll do a lightning round. Would they just try and, like, whip out answers?
So, to help us out,
from The Tonight Show and Comedy Central, please welcome our very own self-proclaimed sex ed expert, Joe Firestone.
Hi! Should we stand with this between us or come
further?
Do
you want to stand far apart or closer together?
I think we should... stand here.
Okay.
So, Joe.
Yes.
Yeah. What made you our sex expert?
Well, you asked and I just said it. And I actually probably have had sex less than everybody here.
But you felt ready to answer these questions.
I mean, I figure at that level, I think I could handle it. And I just want to say I'm nervous about the speed.
Okay. Okay.
It is a lightning round.
I understand.
All right.
It's raining outside. Oh.
Oh, okay. I'm ready.
Okay. There's no ticking.
Unless you want there to
be. No, I do not want ticking.
Ready?
Yeah.
Does breast milk taste like carton milk?
No.
I take long hot tubs. Does that mean I won't make a lot of sperm?
What?
This isn't mine.
Right, of course. No, you have so much sperm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't worry about
okay.
it. Lots of sperm.
How long do you have sex for?
2 to 20.
The time of this lightning round.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I heard my friend lives off donuts in McDonald's. What do I do?
Of passion and love.
How big can a penis get?
Huge.
Why do we do this anyway?
Because we don't want to do math.
My mom buys me books that answers my questions. I still want to ask her my questions, but I don't want her to get mad. What should I do?
Oh, definitely take her out to lunch.
Other girls have developed, but I haven't. Can I use a cream? Think it's any cream you can think of.
I mean, I think creams are always good, especially in winter. I would say go for it.
A little coconut butter?
Yeah, it's going to happen eventually. Just keep, moisturize it. Ready? Get it ready.
What happens when two sperm reach an egg at the same time?
Twins!
Can people have sex with objects?
Yeah!
How does a girl not get the sperms?
She shoos them away.
Why do kids start to like each other in fifth grade?
It's exposure. It's just exposure.
You surround them long enough, you just start.
It's a horrible psychological. Homeschool them.
How does a penis fit in a vagina?
It's really hard, but there's a lot of maneuvering, and I would say use each other.
When girls are still young, does milk come out of their breasts when they squash them?
I guess it depends how hard you squash them.
Why do girls have the baby and feed it and help make it and the boys don't have to do anything but help make it?
It's so fucked up. It's so fucked up. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't understand. I wonder that. Can I keep that one?
Yeah. Yeah. This is a rain-related one.
Yes.
Can a penis shrink or grow because of the weather?
Yeah.
Anyone?
Yes? Yes.
I have a crush on someone. How do I tell her?
Oh, obviously, hidden messages. Definitely don't be direct. I would say gifts.
I had the white, clear, oily substance on my underwear. What should I do?
Laundry.
Why, when a boy sees a girl he likes, his penis hardens and sticks up?
It's the eternal question. And I guess the answer is the penis is guiding you towards what you should be doing, which is your homework.
And that's a show!
Radiolab Team Gonads is Rachel Cusick, Pat Walters, me, Molly Webster, and Jad Abumrad.
Live music, along with the Gonads theme, was written, performed, and produced by Majel Connery and Alex Overington, with live event production help from Melissa LaCase and Alicia Allen, and engineering by Ed Haber and George Wellington. Special thanks to Upright Citizens Brigade, featuring Lou Gonzalez, Molly Thomas, and Alexandra Dixon, and to our panelists, Delia Mahgoub, John Zimmerman, and Erica Hart. Before we go, two corrections. Jocelyn Elder's quote read, "As per your specific question in regard to masturbation, I think that is something that is part of human sexuality, and it's a part of something that perhaps should be taught." Plus, Cinda Aga is actually 25 years old. We said 24. Go to our website to see Cinda's images, Sanford's video, and check out our listener-created sex ed bookshelf. It's awesome, and it's for all ages. Thanks so much for listening to Gonads, the series. See you soon.
This is Jen Frolick calling from Berkeley, California. Radiolab was created by Jad Abumrad and is produced by Soren Wheeler. Dylan Keefe is our director of sound design. Maria Matasar Padilla is our managing director. Our staff includes Simon Adler, Maggie Bartolomeo, Becca Bresler, Rachel Cusick, David Gebel, Bethel Hupti, Tracy Hunt, Matt Kielty, Robert Krolwich, Annie McEwen, Latif Nasser, Melissa O'Donnell, Ariane Wack, Pat Walters, and Molly Webster, with help from Shima Oliai, Carter Hodge, and Lisa Yeager. Our fact checker is Michelle Harris.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.